Coming up on Weekend America.
Foreclosures are a problem. So is homelessness. But could two problems together lead to a solution?
We're asserting that our right to housing supersedes someone else's right to profit. And therefore, we have a greater right to vacant homes than a bank who's getting billions of dollars of government bailout money does.
Some homes in Miami aren't vacant anymore. I'm John Moe. Also this hour, combining poets and cocktails.
A cocktail is like an accessory to a fancy outfit. You can see the light shining through. It's like a piece of jewelry or a clutch, a handbag, or a pair of great shoes.
And you thought it was just a drink. Also, Santa, generous, jolly, and black?
It's our job to make sure that our children feel very good about themselves and we nurture their self-esteem. We let them know, hey, this person that you look for once a year, yeah, he's black. Santa for us is black.
But what did the kids say? Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul, where it's heated up to a roasting 30-something degrees. Today, break out the Tevas, fill the kiddie pool, honey. Where's my floppy hat? Hoping you get a chance to unwind this weekend, no matter the weather where you are. Take some time off. Chill, as the kids say. Do the kids still say chill? Do they say chillax now? I've lost track of the kids. This hour, we'll hear about Jews observing the Sabbath and all the effort that sometimes goes into not making an effort. A visit with Santa at the mall is supposed to be fun and festive, but sometimes issues of race can make old Saint Nick more complicated than you might think. And poetry can be inspired by love, even if it's the love of a well-mixed cocktail. What's a good drink to write a poem about?
Cabernet, wine.
That freshly brewed cup of coffee.
I'd have to say water.
Unfinished leftover beer from the night before.
A drink that I would like to write a poem about would be a very refreshing drink known as apple mango tea.
I can make a poem right now about tea. Every night and day, before I go to sleep, I'm going to say maybe here and there, because it's kind of sweet. I may have hot tea or cold drink to drink, mixed with some lemon or fruit of any tree.
Man, I'm impressed. Poetry on the spot. Those voices came from Brooklyn, Denver, and Chicago. New numbers on foreclosure rates came out this week. Nevada still led the nation, but Florida has risen past Arizona to take the number two spot. One in every 173 homes in Florida is now in foreclosure. That means a lot of empty houses in Miami, a place where there are a lot of homeless families as well. One local activist has decided to do something about that. Reporter Andrew Stelzer has the story.
A month ago, Marie-Nadine Pierre and her 18-month-old daughter moved into this four-bedroom house on a tree-lined street in Miami's Liberty City neighborhood.
And that's another room. It has a really good closet, a bathroom, and another room. I've never lived in a place like this before. Like, that was mine.
It's a 1,400-square-foot home with a huge backyard. But the rooms are all empty. There's no furniture to move in. Pierre has been homeless on and off for several years, working all types of jobs to get by.
Everything works, and it flushes everything. Sorry, I just took a shower, and the tub is having a hard time. I have to fix that, but everything works. It's perfect.
Pierre and her daughter were homeless last fall when she heard about a local group called Take Back the Land, a project started by community organizer Max Rameau. He moved her into this house.
So right now we have all around our community, vacant homes. There's no one living in them. They're empty. And we have homeless people living on the street. So we started to engage in the process of matching homeless people with peopleless homes.
Rameau finds peopleless homes, either owned by the government or a bank. Along with a few volunteers, he fixes them up, changes the locks, and moves families in. He calls it liberating homes.
Okay, so we are driving down 15th Avenue in Liberty City, which used to be a very bustling street, but now is pretty empty.
In North Miami, Rameau points out one of the half dozen homes his group has liberated in the past year.
This house here is a few years old, and it's owned by Miami-Dade County. And as far as we've been able to tell, no one has ever legally lived here. But we've moved two families into here, including the one that's staying in there now.
Squatters are nothing new, but what makes Take Back the Land unique is that it's an organized effort. The squatting is done more or less out in the open.
We're not asking people to sneak in the back door through a window. We want them to come in and out the front door. And I think as long as they make good neighbors, I think people are happy to have them there. It's certainly better than having a vacant unit or having a unit where people are going in and taking out copper wiring or taking out whatever it is that they're taking out.
Rameau is aware of the laws that his group are breaking, trespassing and possibly even racketeering. But local authorities say they'll only get involved if they're asked to by the property's owner. Still, City of Miami spokesperson Kelly Penton says they don't condone what Take Back the Land is doing.
It does not help people find a permanent solution for their situation, and also presents concerns related to the safety of these individuals and related to laws that are being broken.
But Max Rameau says some laws need to be broken to make a higher point. He even hopes that the current financial and housing crisis will lead us to reevaluate our entire philosophy about private property.
So we're asserting that our right to housing supersedes someone else's right to profit, and therefore we have a greater right to vacant homes than a bank who's getting billions of dollars of government bailout money does.
Ironically, the house where Marie-Nadine Pierre lives is owned by Aurora Loan Services. That's a subsidiary of Lehman Brothers, the now infamous holdings firm whose bankruptcy sparked the global economic collapse. Pierre stands in her new kitchen with her baby in her arms and says that even the uncertainty of living here is far better than what her life was like before.
Yeah, I'm going to be so thankful. I mean, you know, do you know what it's like to have four kids on the street and have been rained on? My four kids, it poured rain on us all freaking day one time. And no cops, then the cops came.
Three of Pierre's children now live in the Bahamas with their father. She's determined to get them back now that she has a house, but it won't be easy. She already came home here once to find the locks changed and her few belongings removed. But with the help of Take Back the Land, she moved right back in and hung Christmas decorations on the door. In Miami, I'm Andrew Stelzer for Weekend America.
Max Rameau says there are currently 9 families on Take Back the Land's waiting list, and he gets calls from all around the country from people interested in setting up similar efforts in their own cities. You can see the house where Marie lives at weekendamerica.org. While you're there, leave us a comment. Let us know what you think about this arrangement. From Miami, we now travel to Denver, where there's a foreclosure tour going on today. Have you heard about these? We covered one in Cleveland a while back on our show. They load prospective home buyers, and yes, there are some, even in this economy, into a bus, and they drive them around to homes that are on the market due to foreclosures. Today's tour in Denver might not make a lot of headlines, but it has attracted some unusual interest. A Japanese television crew from the network NHK is on board, and they're filming what will be a New Year's special in Japan. Yasue Drabble is an independent producer based in the United States. She's covering this for NHK and joins us now. Hello, Yasue.
Hi, how are you, John?
Good, thanks. What are you seeing out there today?
Well, we are going to see 7 properties today, and so far we have seen 2 houses. And the first house we looked at, we are told, was the worst situation. What we saw was the previous owner removed a couple of pipes, and all kitchen appliances is gone, and most of doors are removed as well. So it's not really moving in situation, but as we understand, it was pretty good buy.
And you're on the bus right now, we should point out. You're going between houses right now.
That's correct. We just arrived at the third house.
Why are Japanese people, viewers of NHK, so interested in housing misery in the United States?
Well, I mean, we're not really interested in the housing misery per se, but, you know, now economy is codependent. Something bad things happened in U.S. will happen in Japan. I don't know if it's or not you have heard this expression, but in Japan, what we say is when the U.S. coughs, Japan gets cold. When U.S. gets cold, Japan gets pneumonia. Mm. And the economic situation in U.S. is so bad, sooner or later, we have to pay the price as well. And the Japanese people are kind of frustrated, you know, some kind of, they call recklessness of spending of American people and influence in the rest of the world, including Japan.
So what's your diagnosis for what we have right now? Do we have a cough or the flu or pneumonia or what over here?
Well, I think you need to go to hospital, you know, being hospitalized. And again, we are joking. Well, when the U.S. goes to hospital, you know, being hospitalized, maybe Japan needs to be what? To get this death sentence?
I shudder to think. Well, your crew that you're working with is from Japan. What do they think of what they've seen? What are the people from Japan you're with telling you?
Well, this, you know, feeling, we have seen worst and the best of America. The worst part is, again, recklessness of spending and excess of consumerism and materialistic society. And don't take me wrong, you know, Japanese people love to shop. When you go to Tiffany in New York, you see like maybe half of customers are Japanese tourists. But what Japanese do is they buy product after save enough money. But while it seems American people spend first, then think about how to pay for it. So that's, you know, they see kind of very negative part of, you know, America, not American people, but system as well. But the positive side is they were just kind of surprised how positive people are. You know, we have interviewed both off and on camera. We are pretty, you know, kind of distressed situation financially. But every single person we talk to say, you know, we're having a hard time, but we know we can make it. Not one single person said, we don't know what to do. But, you know, most of Japanese people under this kind of circumstance, you know, we just cannot imagine, you know, being that positive. So I think they have seen, you know, again, the worst and the best of America.
And how is the process of buying a house in the United States different from how people buy houses in Japan?
Well, you know, one thing that we're just startled is just the people can buy a house in the United States without any down payment. And we are told sometimes people can get like 110 or 120% of mortgage. It's just unheard of in Japan. Most of Japanese consumers put in like, you know, at least 20 or 30% of down payment. Most of times even 40%. It's just not because we have to, but we want to. Mm. You know, not many poor people are really comfortable to have that kind of huge mortgage.
Well, I'll let you get on with the tour, Yasue, and thanks for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you very much for having me on. Thank you.
Yasue Drabble is a producer based in Kirkland, Washington.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
Important questions in Illinois. How deep did the corruption go? Who will be implicated? And most importantly, what's the deal with Blagojevich's hair? Good news, bad news, no news. Next on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Well, if you're looking at unemployment numbers, financial numbers, any kind of business news this week, bad news. But what about the rest of the news? Here to sort out other things that happened this week is our panel. Hollywood hotshot comedian, writer, actor, bon vivant, Dana Gould. Hi, Dana.
Hi.
From Yale University literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hello, Amy.
Hi, John.
Author Nancy French. Hello, Nancy.
Hey, John.
First topic. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, whose name we can all now pronounce, was arrested Tuesday on multiple charges of corruption, including trying to auction off a Senate seat, strong-arming the Chicago Tribune into firing staff members, and, my personal favorite, shaking down a children's hospital for money. Is the Blagojevich meltdown good news, bad news, or no news?
I'd have to say it's bad news that a Senate position only merits $500,000. Especially when some Senate campaigns cost more than $10 million to run.
Yeah, everything's on sale.
I guess. It was like the governor must have thought he was selling the position on Craigslist.
There's two aspects of this story that are particularly fascinating. There's a belief that he might be really nuts, that the levels of delusions of grandeur and the lack of self-awareness are so profound. The other aspect of it is sort of a good news that in this time where America is trying to sort of reestablish its international cred and become more a part of the world community, I think it is a good sign that his hair looks like a Russian hat.
I think it's terrible news for the reputation of democracy. How the heck did we ever elect this guy?
Twice.
That's what it. Yeah, it's really astonishing. It just shows after the triumph of electing Obama and all the good feelings we have coming out of that, it just shows how boneheaded the electorate can be on occasion.
But Amy, I have to say, what with Congressman William Jefferson's misdeed and now this Democratic governor attempting to sell the Senate seat, I just have to say it's welcome to the personal hell that we Republicans have faced over the past few years.
And Nancy, that's a good way to think about uniting the country now.
In our own depravity. You know, it adds so much intrigue to the political season for demoralized Republicans to try to figure out who Advisor B is.
Right.
You know, like this is great drama. I mean, I know it demonstrates moral failure and the way that humanity has fallen under the weight of power. But it's just so dramatic and fun to watch as a political observer.
Next topic. A $14 billion measure to help the troubled American auto industry passed the House this week but died in the Senate. Was the failure of the bill in Congress good news, bad news, or no news?
You know, it's kind of hard to know who to pull for in this issue. I mean, the UAW didn't make the PT Cruiser, you know, and at the same time, you know, they'll shut down the whole national operation for work, you know, that pays pretty well. You know, it's like it's just difficult to know who the good guys are.
Supposedly, the problem was that they wanted the UAW to agree to a set date where they would, quote, become competitive, unquote, with foreign companies, which meant wage decreases and working condition alterations and pension alterations. And it was put into the plan knowing that it would blow it up because they knew they couldn't take it because this small faction of senators didn't want it to go through. They think that everything can be solved in Chapter 11. If they go into Chapter 11, which is bankruptcy, they then go into Chapter 7, which is immediately selling off because they won't have enough bond market support. And that is the end of the American auto industry by and large, which then trickles down to plastic companies, glass companies, the ports. The seepage of job loss is going to be pretty impressive. So it seems to be cutting off one's nose to spite one's face.
In Tennessee, we're the only state in America that's home to American, Asian, and European auto assembly plants. And in fact, I live near Spring Hill where the GM factory is. And all of these businesses are shutting down. And I mean, there's just a palpable sense of fear here.
I think this is bad news for a number of reasons. I think this was a wonderful opportunity to get the kind of leverage we've been trying to get on a really dysfunctional yet really important industry all this time. And so this was an opportunity to have that. And I hope we will have another chance to extend support but also extend those conditions.
Also, the after 9/11, the American government bailed out some of the – you remember the airlines? And then they mm-hmm. eventually filed bankruptcy anyway. And so I wonder if there's lessons to be learned here that – bankruptcy is not the end of businesses and that they can use it as a new start to restructure.
I think had this not happened after the financial market meltdown, that would be a much more viable solution. The problem is right now it's like we're suffering a stroke during open heart surgery.
Final topic. NBC announced that Jay Leno will be staying with the network even after he leaves his host position on The Tonight Show in May. Leno will host a one-hour variety show every weeknight at 10 o'clock, 9 Central on Mountain. Jay Leno has been a consistent ratings champion, and NBC made the move to prevent him from going to a competitor. Is this TV strategy good news, bad news, or no news? Hollywood mogul Dana Gould.
Well, it's bad news for writers because you now have 5 hours of what was normally scripted programming during the week gone.
Dramas like Law & Order, CSI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are ER, I believe, was one. Scripted dramas are gone. And right now, Jay's competition are other versions of his own show. Letterman and, you know, reruns of MASH and Nightline.
They've got 4 talk shows. We're all going to get booked on these shows at some point.
We're all going to be guests. Yeah.
It seems to me a genre that can't be reinvented in anything close to its old form of the variety show. So I'm fascinated to see what a person like Jay Leno will do with this amount of time and this year-round schedule.
Well, I'd have to say it's bad news for people like Conan O'Brien, because it feels like the better guest will go to Jay Leno in a more attractive time slot. The good news of this is that maybe America will put on their pajamas at like 9 and start actually getting the elusive 8 hours of sleep that we're told we need.
You know, television has changed and the great dramas are not on the networks anymore. You know, the great shows are on cable, Mad Men and...
Dana, do you mean the Sci-Fi Channel? Did you forget something?
They have one great show and then 38 versions of Stargate.
I know.
What is the one great show?
Battlestar Galactica.
That's what brought right and left together on this segment over the years.
I know.
When love stretched across ideological boundaries.
Dun, dun, dun,
Battlestar
dun, dun,
Galactica.
Yeah.
All right, that's the news of the week. Now it all makes sense. Thanks, panel.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Nancy French is the author of A Red State of Mind. Dana Gould is a writer and comic whose credits include The Simpsons. Nancy and Dana are united in their love of Battlestar Galactica. We were also joined by Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford. One item we didn't get to. In the Northeast, there are very few acorns this year. They just didn't come in. The result? Skinny, aggressive squirrels. I think that's bad news for all of us who fear squirrels.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
For Jews observing the Sabbath, the idea is to avoid labor. But sometimes that can be a lot of work. Ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Not the easiest week for President-elect Barack Obama. He wants to talk about the auto industry and his new cabinet appointments. The press just wants to ask him about shady dealings over his former Senate seat in Illinois. On the personal side, he's trying to figure out how his daughters can start school on time next year in Washington, D.C. Transition to a new job is always complicated, and multiply that by about a billion, and you've got the transition to the presidency. We're continuing our series Conversations with America, asking writers and thinkers about this idea of transition and what should be on the incoming president's mind. Annette Gordon-Reed is an historian who's written extensively about President Thomas Jefferson's relationship with his slave, Sally Hemings.
My hometown is Conroe, Texas. I was the first black child to go to a white school in our school district. The court had ordered desegregation. I was in the third grade, and I loved to read the biographies that they had at the back of the room. And I read this book about Jefferson, and I thought it was fascinating because he was a person who loved books as much as I did, a person who was curious about the world. Of course, there's the other side, that he was a slaveholder. And he was, in the story, always compared to a slave boy who was his companion, who was always portrayed as always mad at Jefferson. Marse Tom is what he called him, because he wanted to read books. One of my teachers, I'll never forget, she asked the class, "Oh, wouldn't you love to live back in this time?" And I said, "No, because I'd be a slave." My replica of Monticello is buried beneath this pile of papers here. And here's a tiny bust of Jefferson that someone gave to me. Thomas Jefferson's drafting of the Declaration of Independence was sort of a promise that lots of people, blacks, gays, other people, have taken to heart. And obviously it's what we've made of all men are created equal, and we hold him to a higher standard for that than perhaps we do other people. And in some ways, it's not fair. If Thomas Jefferson came back and saw President-elect Obama, he would obviously be stunned. Obviously stunned. I don't think he would be as dismayed as he would have been if Hillary Clinton had been president. I think the gender thing would have thrown him more than the notion of a black leader. I had heard the buzz about President-elect Obama before he was on the national stage. We both went to Harvard Law School. We were both on the Harvard Law Review. He cycled in after I did. The first I heard of him was when he became the president of the Harvard Law Review. And I can say that having been on the Law Review, him becoming president of that organization is surprising as becoming the president of the United States. If I could take President Obama anywhere, I would take him to small towns in the South. I would take him to my hometown. I would take him to little towns that have been decimated by drug abuse, imprisonment of black men and women, and also lower class whites, too. You know, people think of small towns, there's a sort of notion of this kind of bucolic, quaint little places, but there's a lot of quiet desperation going on. Any historian will tell you, we're going to have to wait and see. I mean, I go back to my hometown that was pretty much segregated when I grew up. When we went to the movies, we sat in the balcony. I went to our local clinic, and there was a small black waiting room and a big waiting room for white people. That doesn't exist anymore. But the power relationships in the town are pretty much the same. The economics. So socially, people get along. I see things that I never thought I would ever see. I go through Walmart, and I see white women wheeling around their grandchildren. They're obviously part black grandchildren in the shopping carts. That would have been unheard of back in the 60s, in the 70s. So my historian sense tells me that something has changed, but we don't know yet how profound it is. I don't think it's altered yet the economic or the social realities about race. That's a tricky business. Things can look as if they've moved very far on the surface, but underneath there are structural problems that still have to be addressed.
Annette Gordon-Reed is a professor of law at New York Law School and a professor of history at Rutgers University. Her most recent book is The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. With the weekend comes Shabbat or Shabbos, the Jewish day of rest. From sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, Jewish law forbids certain very specific kinds of work. It means that you can't grab your briefcase and head out to the office. And it also means that you can't do some very simple things like writing or erasing, cutting, tearing, even turning the lights on and off. Thus, Sabbath observers have spent many a Friday afternoon taping down light switches, stashing away pens and pencils, even pre-tearing their toilet paper. Enter opportunity. In recent years, an industry has emerged which manages to combine modern convenience and this sacred time. Rebecca Shear has more.
To understand the Jewish Sabbath, you first have to understand the Hebrew word melacha.
It's a mysterious word that's related to the creative activity that God used to create the world. It's also used in the building of the tabernacle in the desert.
The tabernacle being the portable version of the Holy Temple that the Israelites schlepped around the desert for 40 years. And, says Rabbi Shmuel Vefer of Toronto, by building that tabernacle, the Israelites brought God's presence into the physical world.
But on the Sabbath, we want to refrain from doing that kind of activity, because if we felt ourselves totally responsible for being in God's presence in the world, we'd start thinking we control God.
So what observers of the Sabbath do is take each melacha, or creative activity, that the Israelites performed.
And what we avoid doing is the identical activity or a derivative of activity, which is similar in result or form.
For instance, the Israelites ignited and extinguished fires, so Sabbath observers can't switch an electrical current on or off or burn gas to drive a car. The Israelites sheared sheep and cut animal hides. Observers can't trim their nails or tear toilet paper. So with 39 of these acts to contend with, keeping the Sabbath in today's world can be a challenge, which is why in 2004, Rabbi Shmuel Vefer founded Kosher Innovations.
Our mission is to develop practical, innovative products that help the Sabbath observant community meet the challenges presented by a modern lifestyle.
Their flagship product is the kosher lamp. Its bulb stays on all day.
But it has a double shade.
When you line them up, the light shines through.
And when the windows aren't lined up, the light is blocked. So it's as if you turned it off without having to interact with the electricity.
Vefer says he sold tens of thousands of kosher lamps, along with other products like Shabbos bathroom tissue.
Pre-cut and fold it like facial tissue in a little teeny box.
Even a Shabbos toothbrush and liquid tooth wash, since it's a melacha to spread or smooth an ointment like paste onto an object.
It doesn't do as good a job, but your mouth will feel fresh and clean when you get up and go to synagogue for your prayers.
Kosher Innovations isn't the only company helping modern Jews. Israel's Zomit Institute offers Sabbath telephones, which you dial indirectly with special buttons and microprocessors. And a Michigan-based company is helping them develop a scooter that powers up and starts moving all by itself, thanks to something called Sabbath Mode.
One has a Sabbath Mode, right?
Yes, yep.
Elke Zarhi isn't shopping for a Sabbath scooter. She's at a Boston-area appliance store looking at refrigerators.
Thank you. Thanks for letting us browse.
Yeah, no problem.
Sabbath mode refrigerators, which disable all electrical activities like the lights when you open the door. Zarhi already has a Sabbath mode fridge, a kosher lamp.
It's the best lamp ever.
Even a Sabbath mode oven, which is way too complicated to go into here. Yet, as helpful as these items can be, they can also leave her feeling a bit torn.
Part of Shabbat is not being able to always have your hot, hot food or the convenience of turning your Sabbath mode fridge on. We should hold on to being a little bit less modern just for a few hours. It's nice to keep on to something.
But that something, Zarhi says, doesn't have to be kept on to so tightly or traditionally.
We don't like to live just by the letter of the law. We like to live with the spirit. You know, you don't practice Judaism, you live Judaism. And Shabbat is similar. You don't observe Shabbat. You celebrate Shabbat.
And different Jews celebrate this time of reflection and introspection in different ways. So sure, says Rabbi Shmuel Vefer, not everyone is cavilling over his kosher innovations.
There's some saying, you know what, we prefer to keep doing it the way we've been doing it, follow the traditions.
But nobody's questioning their legality either.
There are things that I could come up with that I feel wouldn't be in the spirit of the Sabbath, which is sort of reflecting on your relationships with your family and your God. You know, if I'm going to take something that's going to make it easy for somebody to not think about God, then I'm not going to come up with that product. Like an example would be put a timer on your television so that it came on so you could watch the football game. That's definitely not something that's going to keep you within the spirit of the day.
Of course, technically, the same goes for radio, though some rabbis state that if it's on when Shabbos starts, you're in the clear. The jury's still out on the kosherness of changing the station, however. So if you're tuned in right now, play it safe. Stick with public radio. Wishing everyone a Shabbat Shalom. In Boston, I'm Rebecca Shear for Weekend America.
This time of year, weekends are a time for holiday parties and all the traditions that go along with holiday parties. You know, the sweaters that you only wear just that one time of year, the conversations that you end up in with people who you're trying to remember the names of all the way through, but you kind of smile and fake your way through. And then there's all the goodies that go along with the holiday party, cookies, eggnog, and cocktails. One of our producers, Angela Kim, was thinking about cocktails recently. Don't worry, after work. She came across a poetry anthology called Lush, and she found it, intoxicating. We asked three of the poets to share some insight about their cocktails of choice.
When you take a sip of a whiskey sour, it first hits your eyes and then your nose. It burns your throat as it's going down like rusty nails. And it reaches your stomach and scratches at its lining. She blends a cocktail to prove she knows the difference between mixed up and confused. And before pouring, murmurs her name into my glass. I drink and feel it at the back of my throat, as soft and scratchy as fiberglass soaked in a whiskey sour. My name is Cindy King. I chose to drink the whiskey sour because I think the whiskey is a quintessentially American drink, and it's got a kind of sinful quality that makes me think about fast times and fast living. A cocktail is like an accessory to a fancy outfit. You can see the light shining through. It's like a piece of jewelry or a clutch, a handbag, or a pair of great shoes. If you don't drink alcohol and you want to opt for something non-alcoholic, it's always nice to just pour some grape juice and a little seltzer water in a fancy glass, and it'll make you feel like you're wearing a cocktail dress.
Monday, we'll see the Cointreau and Grand Marnier at rest on their high shelves, the falsies back in their box, the mirror ball rings and feathery bangles away. And all of us are daylight selves, but now, and for a few sides yet, in pink lipstick and pastel cigarettes, you are the girl for whom such things are done. My name is Stephen Burt. I chose to call the poem Amaretto Sour and to describe an Amaretto Sour because it's festive. It is a drink that is sophisticated and yet dessert-like. An amaretto sour is sweet and sour at once, and it may be sweeter for having a cherry in it, and it ought to be colorful. There ought to be a kind of welcoming tan warmth to it, and if there's a special kind of glass appropriate to that beautiful sweet and sour mixed drink, I'd like to know what that glass looks like.
My name is Sima Rabinowitz. Theories of pattern recognition, movable fasts, Manhattan, the cocktail, and the island. The hungry poetics, a penitent aesthetic. A Manhattan is a beautiful drink. I don't drink Manhattans anymore. But I like to think that I remember the flavor so precisely, not because I drank so many of them, but because the flavor is so exceptional. It's a beautiful color, an amber color that is like nothing else, but has a little tinge of the pink from the cherry. And there's something about that artificial cherry, that strange sweetness and that little artificial glow that's very important, but the actual whiskey tastes very essential, like the earth, maybe just a little bit smoky. I think a cocktail in many ways is like a good poem. It's something that transports you outside of yourself. You shouldn't be stumbling around necessarily. Although good poetry can sometimes make me stumble around quite a lot. But it's something that takes you outside of yourself just a little bit.
If you're listening in New England this weekend, I hope you're somewhere warm and safe. A massive ice storm has brought power outages to over 1 million homes and businesses there. Good luck, New England. With an update on weather and fun, here's Jeannie Yandel.
How do you feel about tubas? According to Denver, you love them and want to hear 300 tubas play holiday standards at the Tuba Christmas Concert. Sunny and 52 degrees, great weather to figure out how to dance to 300 tubas playing holiday standards. Hot chocolate and coffee available, but no earplugs. You don't need them because you love tubas so much, remember? The Geminid meteor shower is called that because the meteors look like they radiate from the Gemini constellation. Appling, Georgia hopes for clear skies during their meteor madness. Stay up all night to watch the meteor shower, then enjoy cheese grits for breakfast. 29 and partly cloudy. Oh, partly cloudy. Appling, if it's too cloudy, maybe you could have cheese grit madness. Throw cheese grits across the sky and pretend they're meteors. No? The problem with parades is they're too orderly. Sierra Vista, Arizona experiments with chaos theory during their unorganized Christmas parade. Sunny and 67 to watch pretty much whoever, walk wherever, and do whatever. And if you get bored, join the parade yourself. From what I hear, Sierra Vista has been not planning this parade for months. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
We've seen paintings of Santa, illustrations, cartoons, but very little photographic evidence exists. So why are we so sure he's a white guy? Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America, supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Christmas at the mall can mean a visit with Santa, and it can get crazy. Terrified kids, harried parents, long lines, a real crisis. For some people of color, the mall Santa can bring on a crisis of a different sort. Weekend America's Desiree Cooper continues her series Inside Blackness about what life is like for blacks in America. And today she looks at the complicated relationship some black families have with the traditional Santa Claus. A warning, if there are kids nearby, this story does address issues of identity.
It's that time of year when we hope that we can just let go of all of our differences and just celebrate the human family. But that's easy to say if everywhere you go, images of Christmas look like you. As a black person, experiencing the season through white angels, white cherubs, and a white Saint Nick can be really tough, especially when you're trying to raise African-American kids who are proud of who they are. So when my kids were little, I started decorating with little brown Santa bears, something wonderfully race neutral. Other black parents have been more direct, like my neighbor, Shauna Morrow. She only decorates with black images of Santa.
It's our job to make sure that our children feel very good about themselves and we nurture their self-esteem. We let them know, hey, this person that you look for once a year, this really good guy, yeah, he's black. Santa for us is black.
Have you been good? You've been doing good in school?
Yes.
All right.
In suburban Detroit, black social worker Jaron Calhoun played Santa Claus at Northland Mall.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Merry Christmas.
He attended the C.W. Howard Santa School in Midland, Michigan. It's considered the Harvard of Santa schools. Of the 70 students from all over the United States and Canada who are in his class this year, Jaron was the only black person. When I asked him why he wanted to be a Santa, he asked me, why not?
When someone's in that suit, the children are completely colorblind. It's really like a spirit and an ideal. The parents are the only ones who will say, wow, you know, a black Santa. But the children, it's like they don't notice.
Well, that's true for six-year-old Elise, who waited at the mall for Santa to arrive. What color is Santa?
Red and white.
What color is his skin?
Huh?
What color is his skin?
Red and white.
But not all African-American children have Santa colorblindness. In fact, there are some black children who flatly reject a black Santa Claus. Leah Washington is an African-American mother of two in Oak Grove, California. And here's how her 8-year-old son reacted to her cherished black Santa figurine.
I took out the Santa, and he said, that's not Santa Claus, Mommy. Santa Claus is white. And so I said, Santa Claus is, you know, different things to different people. I said, but it doesn't mean that Santa Claus is actually white. And he just kind of humored me and said, okay, Mom.
So you don't think he bought it?
No, he didn't buy it.
Well, that's mild. Listen to what 21-year-old Zarina Rashid said when I asked her what comes to mind when she sees a black Santa.
That he's an imposter.
Imposter? Why?
I would not believe that a black man is just running around giving out free toys. I'm gonna shoot a black man coming down my chimney in a red suit, please.
I had some 6-year-old black children tell me exactly the same things. Their parents were so shocked, they didn't even want me to use their comments for this story. They were really worried about their children's racial self-esteem. I asked Dr. Gail Parker what was going on.
I don't think it's directly connected to self-esteem.
She's a Detroit area psychologist who consults with businesses about diversity.
I think it's just that that's the picture that we identify with as Santa. For an example, there are some children who, if you show them a picture of a hamburger, they'll say it's a McDonald's. So branding and advertising and these images that children are bombarded with on television have an impact. They internalize these symbols, and that's what they relate to.
So, when a black child rejects a black Santa, is he rejecting his own blackness or just a phony knockoff?
I think it's more than they were rejecting a knockoff. Up until very recently, this presidential election, if all you knew about black people is what you saw on television, you would have internalized some pretty scary images of black people. And so you might get one of these aggressive responses like, you know, if I see this Santa Claus, I'll shoot him with a bazooka. If I see the white Santa Claus, I'll be filled with joy and glee. What it tells parents is that we cannot take for granted that what we're teaching our children is what they're learning.
Like my neighbors, the Moros, remember them? They take pride in teaching their daughter, who's 6-year-old Savannah, that Santa Claus is black.
Those reindeer had a very shiny nose. If you ever saw him.
I gave Savannah pictures of a black and a white Santa to see how she'd sort them out.
I think these two are brothers.
Maybe Santa has a lot of brothers and they're all different colors.
White or black or brown?
What do you think?
All of them are real. Except one, the white Santa.
Oh, no.
Santa Claus never gave me nothing. Seen him at Macy's, lying in front. So do some good to the ghetto.
Looking for answers in the North Pole, I'm Desiree Cooper with Weekend America.
We asked listeners what they thought about black Santas. You can read the results at our website. Meet a listener who is a black Santa for kids whose parents are in prison, and a black woman who played Santa during an expedition in Antarctica. It's all at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Larissa Anderson, Sasha Aslanian, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Desiree Cooper, Hillary Frank, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Michael May, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Ocean Kalen, Ariel Kitch, Angela Kim, Mark Sanchez, and Chris Wieg. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. Get a free podcast of today's program at weekendamerica.org. Become a fan of Weekend America on Facebook to get updates on the show and ways you can be a part of it. We need your help producing this show. Or you can follow us on twitter.com/theweekend. That's where I found out that Jen in Marshfield, Massachusetts, will be trying to pawn off a ceramic penguin toilet brush this weekend at a gift exchange. Good luck with that, Jen. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
I'm John Moe, host of Weekend America. Sometimes you just need to get away from the stress of the week. We'll take you somewhere new through stories and music.
The music is nothing but this distant, surreal sound, and it's like I'm being transported into this different world. It has something to do with my job or the week that was or civilization as I know it or anything.
All you have to do is sit and listen. We'll do the driving.